Welcome back, everyone, and thank you for being here tonight for book study. I wanted to acknowledge and thank everyone who participated last week in the conversation on meditation and mastering the mind. It was a really good interactive discussion, and really appreciated everybody's contributions to that conversation. This evening, Jackie and Taishin will shine their light on chapter 9, which centers on the teachings about wisdom. Following their presentations, we'll turn the discussion over to everyone present to share thoughts, reflections, and questions. So we'll turn the microphone, Jackie and Taishin, over to you. And thank you very much for leading us through this mighty chapter.
It was a complete breeze. No complaints whatsoever. So nice to see everyone tonight. Thank you for being here. Jackie and I decided that we would stagger our presentations this evening. The plan being for me to share first and hopefully stimulate some discussion. And then when it looks like we could use some new life, new energy, Jackie will share her thoughts and we'll keep discussing and sharing what has arisen for us. And I'll also say before I get started that the question that I want us to at least start exploring this evening is, how do these teachings that we read this past week, or maybe attempted to read and then threw the book aside, how do they show up in our everyday lives? How do they inform or encourage our practice to not just take good care of ourselves, but take care of others, our communities, support our work as bodhisattvas? So you can sit with that question as I read through some remarks that I've prepared. So for the last 2 months, it's hard to believe that it's been 2 months already. We've been diligently studying this text in the Buddha's words from Bhikkhu Bodhi. At first, I found the selections to be accessible, inspiring, and thought-provoking. But as we approach the end of the practice period, and with it the end of the anthology, it doesn't feel like the readings are reaching for my attention anymore. I used to imagine a kind of like hand grabbing me by the shirt collar in the beginning, saying, "Look here, pay attention to this. This is really cool." And now it feels like that hand is actively encouraging me to close the book. We've been eyeballs deep for the last week in this chapter called Shining the Light of Wisdom. And where is wisdom shining its light, you might ask? On many lists, that is where. Many lists that contributed, in my case, to a great deal of head spinning, trouble focusing, and wondering what was in the fridge, even though I looked only 5 minutes ago. We read about the five aggregates subject to clinging, the six internal and external sense bases, the elements, either 18, 4, or 6 in number, the 12-link chain of dependent origination that can be explained in at least 12 different ways, including the 44 cases of knowledge, the Four Noble Truths, the two elements of nirvana, and the 33 synonyms for nirvana. And there are more lists, I promise you, but I think you get my point. Most of these lists are designed to outline, from one point of view, how suffering arises and how we can bring about its cessation. And by the way, it's not by not reading the lists. We learn that suffering arises when we either become attached to something or we come to identify with something. In the former case, we suffer when we cling, for example, to a particular physical appearance because we believe it is essential to our happiness and our well-being. Such clinging brings suffering because all things are impermanent, we lose part of what we consider essential to our happiness and our well-being necessarily. In the latter case, we suffer, for example, when we identify particular feelings or thoughts as who we are and others as who we are not. Such identifications bring suffering because all things are impermanent. We lose parts of what we consider to be ourself necessarily, and in their place arise things that we consider to be not ourself necessarily. So how do we stop the cycle of suffering? By shining the light of wisdom on the aggregates, the sense bases, the elements, and so forth. By direct experience, with support from conceptual understanding, we realize this is not mine, this I am not, and this is not myself. We see from many different points of view that we are attaching to and identifying with things that are impermanent, cause suffering, and are not who we are. With consistent practice, in time, the attachments and identifications cease. We put an end to the rounds of rebirth and attain nirvana. That is the story told, anyway. As I was finishing reading the chapter and its many lists, I was left with a strong impression of their impersonality. I felt their coolness and the almost clinical way they analyzed and categorized the human experience from different perspectives. The I of the human experience felt insubstantial too. This may be an intended effect. In a selection from the Samyutta Nikaya 2295, this is on page 343 for those of you that want the reference, we read that bodily or physical form, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, is like a lump of foam. Specifically, after someone with good sight inspects, ponders, and carefully investigates it, it's found to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. The same comparison is made between feelings and water bubbles that arise and burst on the surface of the water when it is raining, perceptions and shimmering mirages that appear midday during hot weather, volitional formations and someone searching for heartwood in the trunk of a large banana tree, and various kinds of consciousness and a magician's magical illusions. All of them, too, when someone with good sight inspects, ponders, and carefully investigates them, are found to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. All right, but I couldn't help but wonder, why is any of this important? And I kept reading time and time again to stop the cycle of suffering. But I had to ask, at what cost? This determined effort to bring about the cessation of suffering through penetrating conceptual analysis seemed to result in more than just the end of suffering. As we talked about at some length last week, also gone seems joy, dancing, laughter, color, and moments of divine-like inspiration that spur splendid bouts of creativity. And you've never heard anybody say ever, I assure you, please come to my void, hollow, and insubstantial party. Not once. And I'm being a little dramatic here, but only a little bit. You might say that this approach to the Dharma is expected of the Pali Canon. You might mention the cultural and historical climate. You might remind me of its intended audience. But this same emphasis on insubstantiality or emptiness really appears elsewhere. So the Diamond Sutra, for example, closes with the following verse. As a lamp, a cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning, view all created things like this. Notice that the verse closes with the instruction to view all created things as temporary and fleeting, and therefore as void, hollow, and insubstantial, as illusions, waterfalls, bubbles, dreams, and clouds. Not only the parts of sentient and non-sentient beings are like this. And the seventh chapter of the Vimalakirti Sutra has this same orientation towards all beings. The chapter opens with Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, asking Vimalakirti, "Good sir, how should a Bodhisattva regard all living beings?" And Vimalakirti responds by offering 34 comparisons, and I won't list all of them because we don't need another list, but I'll give you some personal favorites. As a wise man regards the reflection of the moon in water, like the seventh sense medium, like the existence of desire, hatred, and folly in a saint, like thoughts of avarice, immorality, wickedness, and hostility in a bodhisattva who has attained tolerance, like the perception of color in one blind from birth, like the tracks of birds in the sky, like the erection of a eunuch, like the pregnancy of a barren woman, like a fire burning without fuel, like the reincarnation of one who has attained ultimate liberation. The list offered by Vimalakirti is striking because of its progression from familiar examples. We also find the foam and the bubbles and the mirages and the trunks of banana trees and the magician's illusions to things that seem of an altogether different category. A lump of foam, though void, hollow, and insubstantial, still exists in some sense. You can inspect it, you can ponder it, you can investigate it. But I don't know what to do with the perception of color by someone blind from birth, the erection of a eunuch, or the pregnancy of a barren woman. How do I inspect, ponder, and investigate these things? I decided to bring in the Vimalakirti Sutra because I don't think you can dismiss it so easily. Its star character is a layperson, just like all of us. It's not a monastic. Vimalakirti is a householder whose spiritual accomplishments rival, if not surpass, those of monastics and other deities. And he's completely immersed in the dusty, mundane, and topsy-turvy world, just like we are. Vimalakirti shines, showing us that the whole of a Buddhist life is available not just to those with shaved heads and broken-colored robes. It's open to everyone. The sutra, perhaps more than any other, is talking to us. But it's part of that life, just like the life we read about in the Pali Canon, that all living beings are regarded like the sound of an echo, like a mass of clouds in the sky, like a tortoise hair coat, like a third rebirth of a once returner, like the unproduced passions of an emanated incarnation of the Tathagata, and many more. The examples are void, hollow, and insubstantial, and many are conceptually incoherent. That, we read, is how a bodhisattva who realizes ultimate selflessness considers all beings. So it's unsurprising that Manjushri follows Vimalakirti's response with yet another question. I asked a moment ago, okay, if I really practice these teachings, I'm supposedly going to put an end to suffering, but at what cost? And Manjushri asked the same question, only more directly. Noble sir, he says, if a bodhisattva considers all living beings in such a way, how does he generate the great love towards them? And that brings us to the question that I thought we should spend some time exploring. How do these teachings about how everything is void, hollow, and insubstantial fit into our practice, fit into our service to others, our communities, and all beings? And I'll leave it there. Thank you. Jackie, please.
I wonder if it's so extreme because We're so deluded about the solidity and permanence of things that we need to be hit upside the head, as Americans say, to break up our illusions. But it does seem very extreme in the examples you give, especially the ones that are physically impossible. So I don't understand those ones.
Yeah. There's something to be said for being provocative. It really stirs one up if delivered in the right kind of way. What about the rest of you?
Michael, could I ask you to restate your question? Maybe it there was a long lead into it, so maybe crystallize the question and that might get the ball rolling.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So let's try this, right? We're not here, I take it, so much to study these teachings from an academic point of view, but somehow they should fit into our day-to-day lives and our actual practice. And the question is, how do these teachings fit in for you? In your experience, this repeated emphasis on the emptiness of all things, how they're void, hollow, and insubstantial, how does this inform or support your practice? Mado?
Yes, it's interesting that you bring in the Vimalakirti Sutra, because Vimalakirti was a bodhisattva. And there's very little that in this reading and probably in everything else that we've read that presages the emergence of the bodhisattva. This is about, for the most part, about the becoming of an arhat. This is the escape from samsara, but nothing about the return to the world. So there's so little to suggest that maybe a bodhisattva could arise out of this. And what it's missing in some way, from my perspective, is when one realizes the emptiness of all things, the other side of that is the connection, the connectedness of all things. That's that's kind of left out. And that's where compassion arises. That's once one sees the other side of emptiness, which is the fullness of life, then that interconnectedness gives rise to the great compassion that that motivates the bodhisattva. So this is where I think if there were some suggestion of the arising of compassion based on the fullness of our connectedness with all things, then I could see how it does affect our everyday life, because this is about relationships. This is about helping each other. But if all we're talking about is the escape from samsara in some monastic setting, yeah, it doesn't. It really doesn't. It doesn't precipitate that return to the world in which we live. So thank you for raising that question. I think the answer for me is it doesn't. It doesn't really connect with our lives because it doesn't look at the other side of emptiness. It just sticks with this, I don't even know what to call it, but this kind of diminishing of this sucking out of life and not replacing it with the fullness of a connection. So thank you, Taishin.
Thank you, Mado.
Can I add something?
And I think I also, let's see, at Jokoji, that is Jerome, I think.
Jerome, why don't you go ahead?
Well, you can see here, we have some flowers that just marvelously came, were brought here the other day by Michael Schnee. I find that, you know, about as far as the transience of things, it seems to me that the reason we appreciate flowers as much as we do is because they are transient. We don't appreciate plastic flowers or artificial flowers nearly as much as flowers like these. So I think that it's in the transience of things that we are, in a sense, energized by their very transience, and thus we are more willing to really be present in this moment because this is the moment. So I don't think we should, I just don't go along with this sort of dismal feelings that the chapter gives us regarding transience. We, in a sense, we have to celebrate the transience.
Thank you for that. There were other hands.
Oh, thanks, Anita. Why don't you go ahead? Can everybody see?
Hi, everyone, and thank you for your thoughts. So Taishi, I had to say I suffered through the chapter, a lot of it myself, but did I really? And I had the same question, so I thought, well, I see it a lot as the relative and the absolute, because I had to simplify it, I think, somehow at times. And then I was thinking, well, we absolutely live in the relative, and he is really teaching absolute. So for me, what I had to take away was just keep noticing. Just keep noticing my thoughts, my attachments to my thoughts. And yeah, so it, and a lot came up too, but you quoted one of my favorite quotes about the see everything like this, the bubble and the dew. And so, thank you.
Thank you.
I was thinking that, you know, maybe that was the intent in these teachings, by focusing on the impermanence of everything and talking about the voids, that the other disciples would have the same reaction as you guys, as far as reacting to it and wanting to seize life a little bit more and pay attention to it more, because it was left out a little bit. Just a thought.
It occurs to me that, you know, in an earlier week, we read a series of accounts of the Buddha's beginning and beginning of teaching, right? And it wasn't just the Buddha sat under the tree for a while and then he was awakened and then he wandered for 40 or 45 years teaching, during which apparently he never said a single word. But there's this pivotal moment where he needs to be encouraged. because he doesn't think anyone's going to understand the teachings, and maybe there are some other things going on there too. But as Mato was sharing, this is what I was reminded of, that the Buddha could have escaped, and it seems like he really wanted to escape. So whether it was his own conscience talking or an actual deity that appeared to him and encouraged him to re-enter the world and share the teachings with others, something seemed to need to pull him back and maybe embrace life a bit more in light of what he had realized, as Jarreau was saying, right? Not look around and say, oh, this is all so wonderful, but I can actually embrace and celebrate this life and share what I have with those who have little bits of dust in their eyes, and encourage others to get theirs a little bit cleaner too.
Daishin, thank you for your comments on tone on this chapter, which I think is something Mato mentioned early on in our book study on another chapter, is, you know, how do you come away feeling about this? And and I share some of what you were thinking and feeling as you read this chapter. And, you know, the word disenchantment is used a lot also in this chapter. It's a good thing to become disenchanted, which is a little counterintuitive and kind of hard to accept. But I also, I think, realize that where the Buddha is trying to go is to share how do we end suffering? You know, that even though we want to go to the great party and embrace the sensual things in our life that bring richness, that bring passion, that bring creativity to our lives, along with that, I think he rightly points out that there is inherent suffering and disillusion and pain. And so I think that's part of what kind of redeemed some of the teachings in this for me, is that I think that ultimately is where he's trying to go with this, is to help the monks and people listening to him to have a way out of suffering. And so I see both the sort of dark side of this chapter, but I also see the bright side as well. It is in his intention, I think, for why he taught this way.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Are there other hands? Thank you, Taishan, for your understanding and your way of communicating about this chapter. I'm going to speak briefly of two big events in my life this week to address how you ended your comments. You used the word love, mm-hmm. and you looked at and made a comment on those both sides of emptiness, or you know, there can be a dichotomy about emptiness. I'm remembering when you spoke about emptiness to our group in Santa Barbara when you were postdoc, and it really opened me up to a new understanding there. So I think you've had a long time of looking at how we use emptiness in the aspect of connection. So briefly, two events this week. I had mentioned last week that someone from Nepal was going to be speaking, and I did go to her presentation and I did buy her books. The way relates here is that I think in this chapter, there may be a reference, I wish I could be scholarly and remember that reference of when the basket collapses. There is someone who approaches the temple and her basket gives way, or his, and in that moment, realization comes. So I saw two people this week whose baskets, well, a multitude of people in Nepal, whose baskets fell apart. at the moment of deep, deep suffering, unconceivable amounts of suffering, human trafficking and HIV transmission. And then what I didn't know were the amount of ongoing suffering from the HIV, and even worse, maybe, the ostracizing of these individuals from their own families and their own communities. So I'm mentioning this because I learned so much from Kranti this week about that, this young woman. But also, when I had time with her alone a couple of weeks ago, she talked about her Buddhist practice. So I want to tell you that. From her mother's devastating experience and near-death experiences, and the miracle of this child being born, Kranti meaning revolution, because she was one of the very first to survive HIV pregnancy. From all that comes a rebirth of their Buddhist practice. How could they even think of it? Because nothing was making sense in their lives. But there was a group of Buddhist monks who started to come to the homes of these survivors and bring the practice into the home. Now, this was revolutionary because nobody else in the village would get near these folks. And they were walking in and installing their altars and helping them develop daily practices around those altars. And what I hear from Kranti is that that is the way they are surviving emotionally, because it feels like protection in their homes. And these monks do come and practice with them at certain holidays and so forth in the home. So that's one example. The other is, briefly, a close friend of mine, recently widowed, surviving some very serious health issues, surviving so far sarcoma, which is considered really rough, found out this week that there's something in her liver. She's a very, very important teacher in my life. She announced this to us over a Zoom yoga session with us as her students, because she had just gotten the news 15 minutes before about her liver. And she asked for our support because she wasn't feeling like teaching the energetic class she had. And we all talked with her. We sat and meditated with her. And then she got up and showed us all the stuff she had planned, even though she didn't lead us through the class. In other words, she got back on her feet. And what she reported to me is that not only does her practice support her, her daily practice, but her dog, who's her only companion now, who from that moment when the phone call came from the doctor has started to sit on her lap and sleep on top of her. So this is just, you know, my way of describing to you the way the basket falls out and our lives tumble. And somehow, how do people find these miraculous ways to find love and support and emptiness? And that emptiness of connectivity that keeps them going. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That was so the lesson, or one lesson that it sounds like I'm taking away from this, is that when the basket falls out, as it's always falling out, then there's space, as there's always space, for other things to come in and be supportive and be nourishing. The emptiness, while it can, if viewed in a certain way, make things seem bleak and unattractive, can also keep things fresh, because nothing sticks for all that long. It's again why we appreciate the flowers as we do. Bill, did I see a hand? Yeah.
Yeah, I share your frustration to some extent, Tyson. I had to read in Sanskrit for an entire year of these texts and the Abhidharma texts. And that was painful, excruciatingly painful. I'm coming back and looking at it now, and I love it because this is an old friend, but it still gets me, and I still sympathize with you. I was glad to move on to the Vimalakirti and then even to the Prajnaparamita, because that's where my focus was. And they have the same response you were suggesting there, that the Arhat is a different kind. They're the ones who got the first part of the message, but they need the rest. Mm-hmm. And it's both basically a refutation of the initial goal. But in sympathy with this text, I see a kind of deconditioning process. We come into a world and immediately start being conditioned by greed, hate, and delusion that surrounds us. Mm-hmm. And this is a question that Michael has raised. We sense the hate. We feel it ourselves. It's not just around us. It's in us. And so I read a review. I haven't seen this Academy Award winning movie. It's a dramatization of the director of Auschwitz who lived right next door, the crematoriums. And he says it's not about the Holocaust. It's about this family living on the other side of the wall, totally blissfully leading their life in who knows what, forgetfulness or ignorance. And they're right across the wall. The kids are playing in lawns and they're leading ordinary lives. And that was one of the descriptions of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva sees suffering where we don't. Many of us don't. There's much more suffering than we can handle, actually. Most of us, I can't. But this film was made before Gaza and Israel, before the October 6th. But it's coming around. He hadn't even conceived that this is a possibility. But this massive amount of suffering that's in the world right now, what do we do? And I ask myself, what do I do? What's the Bodhisattva path in this situation? Plant animal die-offs. I mean, we're really coming into a vortex here. No, that doesn't mean that I close that eye and open the other eye. Yeah, it's good. The moments that are more fulfilling are only distinguishable because of the suffering, but the mass of other people's suffering is what concerns me, and what do I do? I don't know yet, but it's enough to ask the question. So actually, I see these texts and these lists as a program, not in a all at once thing, but a graduated deconditioning of the conditioning that we come in inherit when we enter the world and engage with the world. And it's done in monasteries, in meditation, by and large. And the major issue is where it's our mind. So I sent a cosmology to the Bariko mounted, or someone put up for me. And I call it the Buddhist Trekker's Guide to the Cosmos. In other words, it's a map. And in fact, other people have described it as a map of the mind. And it's an attempt to encompass the entire cosmos of mental thoughts and images. And even the four, what are they called? The four unlimitables, sympathetic joy, compassion, and finally equanimity. Those are all included in the four jhanas in the second level. And So those are constitutive of an experience that we can have, I think, through meditation and through other pathways as well. That's where it was going. But it kind of got, you know, Taisha, and you've been in this world, like maybe the academic world, we kind of get on high energy gas and run with something for a long time because it's so, I got it, I'm figuring this thing out. And that's part of my reaction to this. I love this stuff right now. I didn't like it in the old days. And I take it with a grain of salt. But I appreciate your critique of it. I mean, I think that's what brought on Mahayana and the heavy response that took place. But they wouldn't have had the Mahayana response, and the Diamond Sutra wouldn't have been the Diamond Sutra without the statement of this that's our make here. Mm-hmm. So it's even the Mahayana is conditioned by these previous things because it's a response, it's a negation, or it's a transcendence. Of that. So is it possible, this is the question I would ask, is it possible to hold both simultaneously? And that's a question. I have no answer to that. I have inclinations, but no answer. Thank you.
Thank you. I also have no answer, predictably, but I do have appreciation for the suggestion of a program of deconditioning, as you put it. I can see it offering us opportunities to open ourselves up to suffering that we might not otherwise notice, got, you know, blinders on of some sort. And I can also see it as a way of maybe helping us not become overwhelmed by the suffering we see when some of that deconditioning takes place, in a way that might, say, cause me to shut down when I look at a number of the ways in which systems, people, places, animal kingdoms are suffering today. So thank you. That's a different perspective that I hadn't appreciated before.
Well, perhaps I can start my presentation. And I'm happy to step in and do this because I'm going to talk about the humor in one of these lists, which I think it's funny. We'll see if anyone else finds it funny. I have a few other things on my mind, but this one seems to follow on. I appreciate what everyone has said about this, and I'm very touched by what Bill said and Tova. But I'm kind of on a different tack here. So these many interconnected lists. So I want to talk about a discourse on right view, which is on page 323. I call this a tale of entailments and monkish humor. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I notice here is that Sariputta and the monks address each other with familiarity and friendship. And each of the 16 sections has chunks of repeated text. And in I'm only suggesting that this is humorous, it's just an idea. But humor involves repetition. Repetition escalates the humor as well. So they say, good friend. Oh, so they're addressing each other, and there's a sense of informality between them because they're friends. And then another thing that speaks of the lighthearted tone is this repeated opening. So they say, saying, good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Sariputta's words. And then beginning with the second section, they ask, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has confirmed confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this new Dhamma? And Sariputta replies, there might be, friends. And I think the humor is that everyone knows the joke. Every other way is essentially, it entails all the other ways. And there is kind of only the one way, which is this same Noble Eightfold Path. And they're all of the sections, at least the 12 at the end, are sort of interconnected. Each one kind of entails the other, so that it's kind of essentially one thing in the end. And another thing I'd like to mention is this patterning. Is it an aesthetic pleasure to people of that day and age who didn't have writing? Because it's very, it reminds me of Bach, okay? So I like counterpoint, which is many melodies intertwining, and I enjoy Baroque music. And it sort of reminds me of that, because this one in particular is, it's like a fugue almost. It's very structured. And I just wondered if in that day and age, people who are in a pre-literate society have a whole aesthetic to do with the structure of the lists and things that helps them remember and enjoy. And we just don't see it that way. And Bill might be able to answer that question, because I know you're such a deep student of all this. I just wonder. And then there's so many patterns within this, you know. There's a pattern at the beginning of each section, and there's a pattern at the end of each section, which is like a whole paragraph of repetition. I don't know if I should read these. I could read the, all right, I'll just say it. Saying, good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has confirmed confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the item in this particular section, the origin of the item, what is the cessation of the item, and the way leading to cessation of the item, in that way, he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has confirmed confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at the true Dhamma. And at the end, the pattern is, when a noble disciple has thus understood the item, the origin of the item, the cessation of the item, and the way leading to the cessation of the item, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has confirmed confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. I love that. I don't know why. And we end up at the Noble Eightfold Path all the time. And so the first three are a bit different. And after three, when we get to aging and death, birth, existence, etc., then it's very, very structured, such that, you know, for the one relies on the one that comes next. So it's this pattern of being kind of a backward forward connection. So aging and death, with the arising or with the cessation of birth, there is the arising or cessation of aging and death. And then you go to birth, and birth with the arising or cessation of existence, which is the next one, there is the arising cessation of birth. I find that kind of intriguing, how the lists are linked that way. Each of them is linked to the next one, and it feels backward. It's odd and it's tricky, and I like that it's tricky. And it all comes back to the one thing, which is Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path. And so there is only one way, and that's the joke, right? There's only one way, actually. And I can just imagine them all falling over, all these monks sitting in their robes, falling over, laughing. They think that's fun. So that's my main and all the other sections, they all seem to say all the same thing as this one, but just different words and structures and so forth. So I don't think you have to read everything. I think you have to pick one and read it, and you have the whole thing. The other thing I wanted to mention, which relates to Taishin's comments about the insubstantial aspect, and please come to my void, hollow, and insubstantial party, no one said ever, which I thought was hilarious. The idea of insubstantial entities. Now, anyone that knows me at Jikoji knows that I'm a fan of Carlo Rovelli, who is a physicist who writes wonderful books for the general public, and he works in the field of quantum gravity. He's very out there, but he's a great ideas guy, and he has a whole chapter in his book on quantum mechanics on Nagarjuna. I don't know how you say it. Is it Nagarjuna or Nagarjuna? I don't know. Is it Nagarjuna? No, Nagarjuna. Okay, Nagarjuna, thanks. And in his view of quantum mechanics, he says, he is very Buddhist. I mean, it's not surprising to me that he talks, but he says, the world that we observe is continually interacting. It is a dense, this is Rovelli about quantum mechanics. It is a dense web of interactions. What we call reality is the vast web of interacting entities of which we are part that manifest themselves by interacting with each other. In other words, there's no I am, there's no objects. Everything comes into being by interacting. And his ideas are really great. The discovery of quantum theory, he believes, is the discovery that the properties of any entity are nothing other than the way in which that entity influences others. It exists only through its interactions. And this just reminds me an awful lot of everything I'm reading and learning about Buddhism, and I'm not an advanced scholar of Buddhism. He says, Nagarjuna, the central thesis of Nagarjuna's book is simply that there is nothing that exists in itself independently from something else. The technical term is emptiness. Things are empty in the sense of having no autonomous existence. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is part of what we're getting in the lists about the, you know, void, no fun parties. In fact, interdependence, and this is the key argument made by Nagarjuna, this is quoting Rovelli, requires us to forget all about autonomous essences. And that reminds me of what Bill was saying about the sort of deconditioning of our minds through these things. Let's see, there's... Okay, that's about it. And so, you know, that dependent co-arising and is something that seems very real to me and easy to understand, because it fits a lot of other things in my reading and understanding. And I find the teachings of the Buddha like a drink of water. They just go right down. They make so much sense to me. But as far as the other things, like what I would like to know is, well, how do people pick and choose? I mean, how can you like, oh, I like this part, I like this, but I don't believe in rebirth and a bunch of the other things and the social mores of the day that come into some of these texts that we're reading. How do we handle these ancient beliefs which are pre-Buddhist in things like rebirth? So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
I just have a thought. Thank you, Jackie. I just have a thought about what, like Chris might say, as he said when he was talking about his chapter about rebirth. And the question would be, who is being reborn? Or what is being reborn? That to me would be a Buddhist way of looking at something. Or that question that just came to mind. So I shared it.
I can see that that's a way for us to understand it today in a kind of metaphorical way, but not a literal way. But it seems like in these writings in the Pali Canon, it's a very literal belief. And it's in the sutras and everything. So how do we reject that, but as a literal belief? Or, you know, what's the justification for accepting one part and not another part?
I wouldn't know, but I'd also think that the Buddha was teaching about samsara, and you're going to be coming back to life and repeating life or living another life over and over. So that, to me, could be literal, but I don't know how others would take it.
I see Diane has her hand up.
I so appreciate what everyone said and putting things together. Maido, thank you. I find this book really stale. And the way I've learned about Buddhism is from teachers and the way they teach, they're transmitting something that I find very exciting and very alive and very useful. And then I think in our tradition, I mean, it sounds like you have a lot of people who have much more expertise or academic background and know the languages of the original things and all of this. But it seems like when a teacher, my understanding is when teachers become qualified, they're getting a transmission from their teacher and it goes all the way back. So my practice of Buddhism has been, you know, practiced, but mostly from teachers, but it also consists of some book learning from some teachers of the, you know, qualified teachers. But that's basically what, so that's what I'm getting, you know, it's, I think it's more direct from people. So I wouldn't ride or die this book because there's so many, for me, questions about it, like Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is he? You know, a lot of these folks who translated things, they were people who had the opportunity to study it, leading universities or the wherewithal to travel and study these languages, and maybe weren't so connected with, you know, regular everyday life. I don't know. But that's kind of my point is I learned from teachers and it's exciting. And then there are books of by these teachers and it's more direct. So when I'm reading the chapter, I don't, you know, all of this about these different levels of, okay, great. I burned through my karma, but I got some trace from a few past lives. I'm not going to give that. I don't care. And I don't think, to me, that doesn't ring true. And then all these permutations of awakening, to me, I think that what's possible, in as much as I can understand, is equanimity. That's my goal, awareness and equanimity, and right action's right action. you know, not all this formulating and, you know, emotion, that was pretty much what I came from it. So I took a deep dive in the aggregates, but I went to other resources. And I had a really good walking meditation outside of just feeling like I'm a receptor, right? Because I'm curating reality based on what, on this package. So I can appreciate what everyone said. And this book, I'm not going to rely. I haven't really, there's nothing really here I really rely on. I can appreciate how it kind of, you know, mentioned the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. And thank God I've heard from wonderful teachers about this and people who exemplify this. And there's no shortage, you know, there's really no shortage of, especially where I live and with the website, you know, of listening to people, you know, transmitting the Tathagata's true words. And it's easy, you know, to remember and accept. But a lot of this, it's just great, you know, great. I'm glad this is a historic document. And if people get a lot out of it, wonderful. I didn't make a single mark in it. I cannot wait. I have an organization that I'm giving this to. So anyway, I hope I didn't. I work at a radio station, so I say the views and opinions are mine and not necessarily that of anybody else's. And I sure hope I didn't offend anybody.
Thank you. I definitely appreciate what you say about the transmission, and I think that's very wonderful. And the teachers having just people to learn from, and the tradition that comes down, and the different lineages, I find that lovely. Thank you, Diane.
And it's from the Buddha, like directly.
Chris, I thought I saw your hand, Chris. Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. Isn't it interesting what we choose to look at? There's so much important stuff in this chapter, and I tend to be like a lot of other people. I'm looking at the stuff that bugs me. And, you know, what is laid out in this chapter are like the foundational aspects of our practice, impermanence, non-self, the Four Noble Truths, this really wonderful stuff. And I'm looking at like a big objection to me in this chapter was when he talks about when you have a tendency that is the basis for continuing consciousness. Literally, he says that. And so that means that consciousness will travel and be reborn. And the first thing I think of is of this massive duality, which seems, you know, completely anathema to the practice, this duality of consciousness and form. And I'm constantly looking at other things that really bother me about the chapter. And I have learned in my life to see the things that I have aversion for, particularly as shadows of myself. So, for example, my issues with rebirth, I think, might stem from my secret hope that there is something, you know, after, you know, this idea, I don't know about a secret hope, but this is somehow in the back of my mind that I will continue somehow, even though I don't intellectually believe that that's going to happen. And I also focus in this book on the way he talks about women, the place of women, the fact that you have to take care of your slaves. The fact that the emphasis is placed on, as Taishin said, the void, hollow, and insubstantial, it's really gray, but it isn't. Also, there's so much more to it. So for me, it's like this has been a wonderful conversation because it made me question, why am I looking at the stuff that bothers me when there's so much other stuff in there that I so appreciate. So that's all I have.
Can I jump?
Oh, Tyson, I think your hand was up first. Yeah. And then Bill.
Yeah, Chris, I really appreciate what you said, that there's multiple ways to look at any particular teaching. So I thought I would share that since Mado gave her presentation on karma and rebirth some weeks ago, we've continued to talk about it. And one thing that came up, which I saw on another author, and you gestured towards it too, and what you just said, is you might actually think that you would hope for a rebirth in the future if you would view it as a positive thing. I guess when I think about the possibility of being reborn, I think I'm going to end up in a hell realm or something and be like a banana slug and get stepped on, and that would be really unpleasant. But you could also think about it as, man, I still have all this work I want to do serving other beings, and I can't pack it into just one 80, 90, 100 year lifetime. So wouldn't it be fantastic if I could get like another 100 years to keep on the path? And when that possibility was presented to me, I thought, oh, maybe I really do want to get on board with rebirth. That sounds like a pretty good deal. So for whatever that's worth.
Bill, I think you were next.
Just a quick response to Jackie's question about who's reading this and why. Back in the old days, monks are reading it, and they're reading it without a text. So they're not reading it, they're reciting it. And if you look at the patterns, those are exactly there to reinforce memory. If you know that you go through those cycles, each one, now we're going to step down to the next level, we do the same thing, where you finally end up laughing with Jackie about getting to the end of this. But it reinforces memory, and that's not what we're doing. That's not the kind of text we're used to reading that take us into our practice of Buddhism. And so in many ways, the style is very irrelevant, I think, to our situation here. It's the little things that Chris is talking about that pop out, that resonate somewhere within this without taking the whole ball of wax. Reincarnation. No, I'll leave that to the betters.
Taishin, can I pitch a question to you and to the group, but to you, because you brought up the instance of the foam and the bubble and the banana, what trunk, I guess, and the mirage. And in this chapter, I know in another chapter, Buddha talks about direct experience and direct penetration of phenomena. And I'm wondering what, if he were teaching now, where so much of our experience is mediated by social media, by virtual reality, and now by artificial intelligence, I wonder how Buddha would have us penetrate those with direct experience, because it's in some ways a different way, it seems, of perceiving the world and understanding the world than when Buddha was alive and teaching. So maybe I've got that wrong, but it just intrigued me when I was reading this chapter about the senses and realizing we're perceiving the world differently now, and how we penetrate it is probably different. So anyway, do you have a thought on that? Or does anybody have a thought on that?
Yeah, is the question, what would the examples be? Like, instead of a lump of foam, are we talking about a Michael Bay Transformers movie or something like that?
where you actually can see on screen something you couldn't even dream or imagine, because of the use of technology and ways of stimulating our kind of visual centers. So it feels like the world's different in terms of how we penetrate reality or understand and perceive reality. Yeah.
I'll stop talking in a moment, but the first thought that comes to mind is that, the Buddha probably had many more examples at his disposal today than back in the day. I have no reason to suppose that that's the case. It just feels that way, because there's a lot more of, at least my everyday experience, that's somehow fabricated. That's the word that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Whether it's AI generated text or CGI in movies or the way that videos are edited. And there's this whole scare now about like campaign ads that like aren't even the real voices of the people running for a certain elected office. And you throw a dart, you're going to hit so many different things. You wouldn't have to just stick with things from the natural world if you were so inclined.
Yeah. Mado, were you going to jump in?
Sure, I'll jump in carefully. there is a wonderful section in this chapter called A Handful of Leaves. And you know, in a way that section kind of lifts out for me from everything else, and it kind of addresses all the different ways that we're either troubled by or inspired by or irritated by when we read this chapter. So it's in response to your question about the contemporary world, he probably would have to reach for another handful of leaves from artist that, you know, I'm sure he would be very skillful in knowing which handful of leaves has to be presented to us. So I think it's, for me, that's, this is about skillful means. It's also about questioning whether, as Bill was suggesting, I love that image of deconditioning, that maybe this is the handful of leaves that we need to accept, despite our resistance, despite our aversion to it. So just sort of questioning, is this the handful of leaves that from all the teachings that he knew and that the direct experience that he had, did he choose the right ones for us? And I suspect maybe not on some level, maybe given our particular, the context in which we live, there has to be a different, for maybe even for each individual, there is a different collection of teachings that is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Very helpful. That's okay. We have a few folks with us who have not had a chance to use their voices tonight. And you don't have to, but I wanted to make sure that we invited you to. And I think you know who you are. So we have another minute or two before we sort of wrap up here. But does anybody have any closing remarks or want to share something that came alive for them as they read this chapter that we haven't already talked about? I see you leaning in there.
I'm the garage band that's going after like Queen here. So, yeah, you know, I kept thinking of that phrase. I think it was in Ending the Pursuit of Happiness with Barry Magid that he talks about the practice for him is developing a bigger bowl to hold it all. And I think that's how I'm approaching a lot of this. It's just even this concept of no self and impermanence. I mean, you look at how evolution has informed and constrained the human brain and our minds to where we really can't even conceive of no existence. He's inviting us, these teachings are inviting us to really pursue a perspective that on a biological level, we're hardwired not to pursue, to not to even consider. And so I think I love sci-fi because it gets me good sci-fi because it gets me to consider the possible or the improbable or the impossible. And I've seen so far when I've struggled with quite a bit of this, particularly the gods and the divine aspect, but I really think it's a wonderful introduction for me to cultivate a bigger bowl, to hold more in the realms of possibility. So thank you for the gentle invite and not shaming me.
I would never shame you.
Hi, Shane.
Yeah, I thought I would build on what Michael just said very briefly by saying that one thing I took away trying to find something to be happy about in these readings is the way they interfere with my usual pattern of judging other people, places, and things. If everything is sort of void, hollow, and insubstantial, then these judgments I form, which can keep me separated from other people, can prevent me from feeling the connection that Mado talked about in the beginning, really have nothing to stick to. And so they can drop away. And that invites an openness and a willingness to be of service. So there is some light here for me too, even if I came out swinging in the beginning.
Thank you, Taishan. Mado, please.
Yeah, I just want to offer a quote from Milton in support of our practice in response to Bill's very beautiful question of what do I do in the face of this relentless and vast suffering in the world. And the quote is from Milton, which is, "They also serve who only stand and wait." So I always go to that quote when I consider that we are practicing peace. We're not doing nothing in our practice. That you could say we are holding a space. We are holding this place of peace, and it's not inconsequential that this is a real action in the world, Zazen, our practice, our Sangha. So I'm deeply comforted by that quote from Milton. They also serve who only stand and wait. So I offer that as one way of affirming the efficacy of our practice, that it is a real contribution to the world. Thank you.
That was a lovely substitute for not having a poem this evening. So thank you. Thank you, Mido.
All right. I think our conversation on this chapter has played out, and I think we will close with our usual way of closing. By confirming that next week we will be covering, and there might be cheers here, so kind of keep the volume low, the last chapter that we're going to be reading of In the Buddha's Words. This will be The Planes of Realization, and it'll also provide us an opportunity for everyone to share reflections, not only about that chapter, that specific chapter, but to talk a little bit about the experience with the entire book, because it's really been a full experience and kind of an arc of learning from some chapters that we kind of embraced happily about 8 or 9 weeks ago, to chapters in the middle that got a little more challenging, to this one that was both joyful and challenging. So we'll get a chance to really take a look at the whole experience of reading this book. And thank all of you for your continued participation. It was a great conversation tonight. And then I think we usually close with the refuges.
That's right. Ekudo-san, can we borrow your, will you share your lovely voice with us again?
Sure. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutyampi Sangham saranam gacchami, Tatyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
Thank you so much, everyone. Have a good night and a wonderful week. We'll see you next week.
Good night, everyone. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you, Ekudo-san. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, Chiro.
Good night, Chiro.